Welcome to the Family by T. M. Palmer and J. W. Alexander. We are continuing to read from page 49 for this reading. Chapter 3, Subordination of the Wife. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as it is fit in the Lord. Colossians 3:18. The domestic relations are grouped in pairs with duties, of course, reciprocal. In each case, as we shall continue to see, the nature of the relation, the character of the duties involved, and the temptations by which it is embarrassed are all covered by a single word. In the present instance, that word is submission, the full exposition of which will yield all that is incumbent upon the wife. Indeed, we shall find veiled beneath it the entire philosophy of the domestic state. A comparison of passages will show that it is intended to express exactly the coordination of the wife with the husband. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22, the injunction is repeated in identical terms. Quote, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord, unquote. In verse 24, the word subjection is substituted. Quote, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything, unquote. In verse 33, it is interchanged with the term reverence, quote, and the wife see that she reverence her husband, unquote. In the preceding chapter, the supremacy of the husband was seen to be suggested in a way inconceivably mild, rather than hinted, than distinctly affirmed. The word which conveys the power tones it with a softness that takes off the sharpness of its edge. As soon, however, as we reach below the husband, we touch the relation which is subordinate and where human authority is, for the first time, to be acknowledged. We encounter now a second will, which must move freely upon its own pivot and yet harmonize with the will which is first. We are fairly abreast of the great problem in both law and grace. What shall be the relation between these two wills? How shall they coalesce and yet be distinct? How shall one be superior to the other and both be free? How shall subordination exist without destroying the spontaneity of that which is controlled? The reader will observe that the difficulty presents itself in the severest form just where it first encounters it. The woman, before she became the wife, was wholly independent of him whose authority she is henceforth to recognize. The relation is grounded simply upon their mutual choice and does not pre-exist by any connection of blood or birth. In fact, we are just at the point where all human ties find their origin, the conjugal relation being that out of which they spring and which is necessarily antecedent to them all. The woman must, therefore, relinquish her independence and must voluntarily assume the obligations for which she exchanges her own freedom. Nay, in framing the contract, she appears as the equal of him, beneath whose scepter she consents to bow. The negotiations are transacted with her not only as independent and free, but as in all respects the peer of her future lord, until the bond is sealed by which she resigns it all. What still more complicates the case, this equality of rank must be maintained after the union as before, that, being his counterpart, she may be associated with him in a joint rule. If the husband being king, the wife must sit at his right hand, an acknowledged queen, sharing equally the honors of royalty. In these particulars, The subordination of the wife differs from that in the other relations of the family. The child, for example, is born in a state of dependence, and at the first dawn of intelligence finds itself under subjugation. It is called to no surrender of prerogatives and raises no question as to its station or rank. All this has been antecedently determined without its voice being heard in the decision. Its will has been manipulated and put under control before it knew it had a will. The only point it can debate is whether to continue in this condition of subserviency or rise in insurrection against authority already established. Not one of the difficulties is presented to it which confront the wife, who must contrive how to be subordinate and yet an equal, how to resign her independence and yet be free, how to surrender her will and yet preserve her personality. It is curious how often in life the solution of a problem springs from the bosom of the perplexity itself. We have been hiding the wife away in a nest of contradictions, and before we have had time to wonder at the complications, she clears them all at a single bound. By one supreme act of will, she cuts through these entanglements at once. It is exactly defined by the word submission, which designates the precise quality of her subordination. This may require a little elucidation. 1. It is an act of unconstrained choice. The word submission technically expresses this. It is, therefore, in Scripture, the preferred term. Subjection, with which it is sometimes interchanged, is less felicitous, since it may convey by association the idea of compulsion from without. But the freeness of her own choice is signalized in this. In assuming the relation of a wife, the woman surrenders much. Still, it is a surrender. There was a moment when her independence was undisputed. If it be resigned, it is through the election of her own will. The considerations which were addressed to her judgment or to her fancy led her to prefer the new condition, where, if her freedom be restrained, certain advantages occur, which, in her esteem at least, more than compensate its loss. In the comparison between the two, she deliberately chooses to be less free in order to be more happy, and therefore she submits herself. In this, there is a manifest reservation of all her original dignity. No sense of degradation can attach in the voluntary surrender of what she might easily have retained, and in all the friction of will she may hereafter experience, there is a pleasant recurrence to this fact. She retains a sense of freedom in the conscious freeness with which it was resigned and with which it continues to be resigned. The absolute freedom of her own surrender of freedom comprehends within it all the acts of subsequent submission, and it makes them as free as the very freedom which she has forever renounced. So far from being dishonored in her subordination, it is throughout life a conscious consecration of herself to the condition of her choice, and the sentiment is one by which she is consciously ennobled. 2. Woman is led to this submission by the instinct of her nature. Many things are made easy to us by the dispositions which adapt us to them. It would be the strangest of all omissions if we should overlook in this connection the different mental and moral organization of the sexes. Man is endowed with attributes which qualify him for his more obtrusive position. He is strong, forceful, massive, fond of adventure, full of dash and courage. The woman is not less equipped for her station by the qualities which distinguish her. She is endowed with grace and beauty, to win rather than to subdue. Exercising the passive virtues of patience and fortitude, of gentleness and humility, and, above all, crowned with that sense of dependence out of which submission springs as an instinct. We strike just here the principle which determines the whole case. God never meant the vine to grow like the oak of the forest in sturdy independence buffeting the storm, but to clasp with its tendrils the support given to it, to twine around that oak itself, covering its limbs with rich foliage and lifting its frail head sometimes even above the rugged strength by which it is upheld. This is more than a figure of rhetoric. It admirably depicts the clinging dependence which is constitutional with woman. As the vine has a root of its own, which is the source of its life, so is the wife rooted in the consciousness of her distinct personality. As the vine grows by the power of a life within itself, so does this personality of the wife find expression in the free exercise of her own volitions. Yet, as the vine clings to the rude prop by which it is sustained, so does the gentle will of the wife knit to the will of which her own is the counterpart. Where human nature only in its original and normal state, the two would move together without friction or jar by a happy coalescence. But in its fallen estate, it must be controlled by positive law, quote, added because of the transgression, unquote. To the woman it is given in the words, thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. The collision of will to which sin now exposes her is obviated by positive statute, vesting the supremacy where it existed before by the appointment of nature. Just as the law of labor imposes upon fallen man only industry which was a duty from the beginning, so the law of obedience imposes upon the woman only the subordination which existed from the moment she was created. In the one case, the employment intended only for recreation has deepened into toil. In the other, the submission intended for repose is changed into discipline. But in both alike, the curse becomes a blessing through the patience which willingly accepts it. She was at the first builded out of man. She must now build upon man. Nature itself teaches that the rib must find its place in the side from which it was taken. The ideal unity can only be restored by a mystical blending of the two into one again. The wife only obeys an original instinct in the voluntary submission, which sweetly expresses the harmony of two distinct personalities and nothing more. 3. Just here comes in the influence of love, holding them together by its magnetic attraction. It is God's plan to induce a sense of want and then, in his providence or grace, to satisfy it. By this means, he combines the human element and the divine in the administration of both. Thus, Adam was made to experience the need of fellowship, as the animals filed before him in pairs to receive their names. To this developed feeling, the Lord responds, quote, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him an helpmeet for him, unquote. And in the strength of this awakened desire, Eve is greeted with the welcome, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. The history pauses, even in its singular brevity, to commemorate the fact that, from the beginning, marriage builds upon a sentiment which can find enjoyment only in fellowship. As we trace the foundation of this tie in all generations, the antecedence of love to marriage becomes more conspicuous. Affection is first aroused, and then the relation is established which gives it scope. The secret life of the conjugal bond is this antecedent love, through which it becomes more than a contract, tract, but rather a true fellowship. It particularly concerns us, however, to note the influence of sex in determining the quality of this love. Indeed, it does not require the most delicate observation to discover sex in human love through all the relationships of life. The mystery is no greater than that of sex in intellect and of sex in character. Mind in woman is essentially the same with mind in man, and is governed by the same fundamental laws. Yet who does not know that, in both, its operations are qualified by the influence of sex, which justifies us in speaking of the male and of the female mind? Character is substantively the same in both, including the same elements and requiring the same discipline. Yet in both, a peculiar shade is imparted by the peculiarities of sex, so that we speak of a masculine and of a feminine character. Equally so with the heart. Love has the same principle or root in both, but it is modified in its exercise by the influence of sex. This constitutional distinction between the two reveals itself more clearly in the affinity which draws them together and in the specific differences of the affections as they cross over from the one to the other. No man ever loves one of his own sex, and no woman one of hers with the precise regard either feels for the other. There is a peculiar quality in the affections when it is interchanged, which nothing will explain but the difference of sex. We shall find this feature running through the family constitution. The father's love for the daughter casts itself into a form which distinguishes it from what is felt to the son. The mother's attraction for the son is slightly modified from that she entertains for the daughter. In neither case is it stronger or more sincere. Identical in nature, they differ only in the form in which they are disclosed to consciousness, the same as to substance, different only as to quality. The lines of parental affection cross each other in this way for the purpose of bringing the whole into closer unity. The same principle occurs in the reciprocal influence of brother and sister, where perhaps by and by it may receive from us a more articulate exposition. In no relation, however, is the case stronger than where we first encounter it, betwixt the husband and wife. The husband's love is thoroughly masculine, springing right out of his nature as man, original, challenging, bold, exactly expressing the characteristics of his sex and uplifting his station as the head. The wife's love is as thoroughly feminine, resting upon her nature as woman, gentle, responsive, confiding, finding its best expression in a yielding subordination. The two are reciprocal and complementary. The opposite electricities attract and adjust by reason of their contradiction. It is not a man's love bargaining with a man's love so much for so much, nor a woman's love bargaining with a woman's love and clashing because they are just alike. But it is a man's love drawing to itself a woman's love, its opposite and fellow. Just not enough alike to clash, and enough alike to coalesce. The husband's strong love rings out its challenging tone, and the wife's responsive love answers with the echo, which does not know how to contradict the sound by which it was awakened. 4. Within her sphere, the wife wields an original authority which she acquires through her submission. This phraseology is not the happiest, but it is the best that occurs to us. Her authority is original in the sense that it belongs to her station and cannot be divorced from it, not in the sense that it is irresponsible and independent. The supremacy vests elsewhere within which her orbit must be described. But it is clear the husband and the wife possesses each a sphere which is distinct. The man as husband, father, and master moves upon a plane which is his own. Neither his duties nor responsibilities can be transferred. So the woman, as wife and mother and mistress, fills a station which is just as exclusively hers, and her trusts are equally incapable of being delegated. This sphere she must fill with her presence and influence, and within its limits in her privilege to move unchallenged. In this difference of spheres, a relief is found from much of the peril arising from conflict of will. So long as the boundaries between them are well defined, and neither party is disposed to invade the province assigned by nature to the other, so long will serious collisions be forestalled. The danger chiefly lies in the personal relation between the husband and the wife themselves, and there the protection must be found in the principles we have already expounded. Let it be observed now that this sphere is hers, as she is the wife, and that all her influence and control within it are acquired through her allegiance to the paramount sovereignty which is vested in her head. Her submission is, therefore, a source of honor. She is not humiliated by it, but exalted. If in her person freedom is in any degree curtailed, in her office as she gained dominion and power, it is not a sacrifice without compensation. She resigns independence, but secures control. Viewing her constitution as woman, there is gain in both. In the first, she finds a restful satisfaction in the clinging trust which leans upon a frame stronger than her own. In the second, that love of influence and power is gratified, which is often an instinct that is noble and good. With her, too, the possession of authority is not burdened with a sole responsibility, but which she divides with him under whom it is exercised. She enjoys the sweetness of office without being overwhelmed with its solemnity. It is easy thus to see that the submission of the wife, so far from being an act of self-deprecation, is recognized as investing her with special dignity and honor. 5. Several minor considerations combine to show that there is no degradation from her original dignity in this voluntary subordination. For example, it is worthy of her most grateful reflection that she occupies the first human relation in which it is given to illustrate God's mode of solving the grand problem of his universal government over intelligent and responsible beings. In her cordial submission of will, carrying with it the free coalescence of her own individuality with that of another, she becomes the first exponent of the mighty principle by which, through grace, sinful man is restored to the fellowship with God. She is allowed to carry this principle down into all the details of life, and by a thousand acts to show how the will may turn upon its own pivot and move freely under the law of control. It is a wonderful privilege afforded to her who, being deceived, was in the transgression, to be called thus openly to assert and illustrate the spontaneous loyalty of a will that perfectly blends with the authority which directs it. Such a mission is immeasurably grander in its proportions and sweeter in its benefits, than all the usurped dignities of the unsexed sisterhood who aspire, contrary to nature, to be the competitor and rival of man, rather than his counterpart and helpmeet. Again, she is prepared for her queenly supremacy as a mother and a mistress by her subordination as a wife. Indeed, her peculiar influence as a ruler springs out of the fact that in her higher sphere she has already illustrated the sweetness of dependence and submission. Her authority is not, like that of the father, naked and hard, but it is authority which has been softened by passing through her obedience before it takes hold upon the child. If she demand of those under her jurisdiction subjection of will, she can point to herself in proof that this is perfectly consistent with the highest self-respect. She enjoins nothing which she does not herself hourly practice. While she commands, she leads in the way of obedience. The lesson may not be given in words, but the quick discernment of childhood discovers in all her actions her own defense to a superior will, her own deference to a superior will. It is comprehended at a glance that subordination of office may coexist with equality of nature, and that submission of will is not equivalent to the renunciation of character. None but the mother can illustrate the obedience which she enforces. As a wife, she has taken off from subjugation the suspicion of meanness, and then, as mother, she binds it, ennobled by herself, upon the conscience and heart of her offspring. Like her blessed master, she has acquired a supremacy through her own submission to authority and law, and has a superior right to enjoin that which she has so supremely honored in her own subjugation. If stubborn pride should still insist that there is ignominy in submission, her sufficient answer is to point to the great mediator, quote, who, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, yet made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and became obedient unto death, unquote. It is enough for her, if she, like him, is exalted through submission to a station of privilege and glory. Reader, is it not beautiful? Well may the apostle enforce this submission in the words, as it is fit in the Lord. This twofold motive will require to be divided by us. They are both of them eminent considerations. As it is fit. This subordination of the wife is urged upon the ground of its meetness or propriety. The duty is thus laid upon her conscience and is not left simply to the operation of instinct. At the very first, the woman did not separately exist. When God executed his counsel to make man in his image and after his likeness, he created Adam alone. The woman existed as yet only potentially in the man, and was formed afterwards by what may be termed a secondary creation out of his substance. According to nature, then, her being is never to be viewed as apart and by itself, for immediately upon her creation, marriage is instituted, by which, in a higher, because moral sense, she is incorporated with him again. She is returned to him, a separate person indeed, but with that person so blended with his own that ideally they are still one as before. The mystery is great, and every reference to it in the scriptures is as a mystery, yet it manifestly includes that subordination which we have been endeavoring to explain. Her natural condition is that of union with man as a portion of him. The wife is always the rib, having her true place in the side, again re-included in the man from whom she was at first taken. In the beautiful language of Matthew Henry, she, quote, was not made out of his head to top him, not out of his feet to be trampled upon by him, but out of his side to be equal with him, under his arm to be protected, and near his heart to be beloved. Unquote. her derivation from man as the rib, and her restoration to him as the woman, are both to be connected together. And their typical significance is that the union in marriage is the most intimate which can be conceived, that it is spiritual in its nature, and that headship is the one with submission in the other, are the two halves that make up the whole. Asterisk concerning the phrase, and that headship is the one. A curious but most emphatic commentary upon the natural supremacy of the husband is found in the Old English law, as it came down from the Saxon forefathers, which construed the insurrection of the wife as an act of petty treason. Quote, this is looked upon, says Blackstone, as proceeding from the same principle of treachery in private life as would have urged him who harbors it to have conspired in public against his liege, lord, and sovereign. And therefore, for a wife to kill her lord or husband, a servant his lord or master, and an ecclesiastic his lord or ordinary, these being breaches of the lower allegiance of private and domestic faith, are dominated petit treasons. Sherwood's Blackstone's Commentaries, Book 4, Chapter 6, finished with the asterisk. Back to the text. It is fit, therefore, that the woman should recognize her subordination as taught in the history of her own creation, for anything else would be unnatural, monstrous, and grotesque. In the Lord, adds the Apostle, this second motive is even more commanding and ennobling. It lifts the wife's submission to the plane of a religious consecration to the service of Almighty God. Indeed, this would seem to flow from the view which we have just presented. For what is obedience to the solemn teachings of nature but obedience to God? In these fundamental and organic laws of our own mental and moral being, not, of course, as they are now perverted by sin, God has clearly expressed his will for the guidance of the creature. But over and beyond this, God has made the subordination of the wife and the supremacy of the husband a part of the constitution of marriage, and has established both by positive statute. Can there be any degradation in the wife's obedience to the law of her husband when this is obedience directly rendered to the authority of God? All sense of shame is dissipated as soon as she rises to this higher view. Her husband becomes to her a crown and a covering as soon as she sees in him the representative of God to her. The shadow of his authority falls with no chill upon her heart when she views it only as the grateful shade from the scorching heats of life. Her subjection to it takes on a religious character. It is of the nature of submission to the divine sovereignty, of resignation to the divine will, of obedience to the divine authority, of rest upon the divine support, of enjoyment in the divine fellowship. Blessed idea of marriage, how imperfectly is it realized even with the best of our race? When the man moves with awe in the majesty of his great trust, tender and loving, full of providential thought and care for those to whom God has appointed him as his own representative, when the woman walks evenly at his side without fear and without shame, yielding in the deepest reverence for his authority, but the homage of her worship to that God of whom he is the shadow.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. You are welcome to make copies and give them to those in need. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. It is likely that the sermon or book that you just listened to is also available on cassette or video, or as a printed book or booklet. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."